Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
Morena, Lara.
Morena.
Hi, Lara. How are you?
I mean, look, I'm pretty good. This is going to be a bit random.
Okay.
I'm organising. Okay, these are lots of words. So follow me. Mm-hmm. I know it's before 8. A Global Indigenous Data Alliance.
Hell
so
yeah.
A group that works on Indigenous data sovereignty globally. So mm-hmm. You've got lots of different Indigenous groups, right?
Mm.
Meeting in Mexico on AI. So, you know, the big challenges of artificial intelligence. And we've got biologists, we've got ecologists, we've got social scientists, we've got economists, we've got the whole kind of range of people. But a Mexican drug lord has been shot. So now everyone's got these travel advisories and some groups have had to pull out. And, so I've woken up to all the emails, you know, like politics, you know, geopolitical tensions get you no matter what, no matter what you're doing. So, yeah that's a random thing for the morning, but that is my main work. And now it looks like we'll have a hybrid session and we'll go on at 4 a.m. So it's fine. But, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Intense.
Yeah, sounds intense. Sounds like an awesome conference, though. It sounds like it's going to be really interesting.
Yes, it will be super awesome because, you know, we know that there's a lot of challenges with AI, especially for Indigenous people around the world, our intellectual property, our, like, culture, māpuranga, all of those bits and pieces. And then you've got, you know, capitalism coming in over it and trying to suck up all the data. There's a beautiful, beautiful quote from Peter Lucas Jones, one of our AI leaders in New Zealand, about how they're like, it's along the lines of, you know, the very people who beat the language out of our grandparents will try and sell it back to our grandchildren. So, yes, I'm a big co-popper, but stuff will happen. Ideas will still happen.
Yep. Awesome. Things are back into the swing of things with politics. Everyone's back in the house. We're deep into election year, and everybody wants to make a State of the Nation speech.
They do.
And nobody really wants to say all that much in their State of the Nation speech.
No.
Eh?
Yeah, you know, speaking of AI, I did wonder if Hipkins just got ChatGPT or would actually write a speech a bit.
Sounded,
you know,
a
like,
little chat.
Spurn.
It's a little bit. So one of the things that we, for example, watch for when we've got students, hot tip, is when there's a lot of words on the page where they don't really say anything. And that's how we detected among colleagues, the youth. I mean, obviously, Hipkins wasn't going to be doing references. He's got some figures in there. He's got some numbers in there. He had some good kind of poignant points in his speech around, like, the number of people going to overseas. It was like 200-something thousand in the last couple of years. And, you know, it was this, I'm trying to remember, he said three towns. I think it was Rotorua, New Plymouth, and somewhere else. There was a little list he had. It's like, that's the population of this many towns. So I quite like that. That was a good high point of the speech. I think that connects to a lot of people, and I think that's going to be a point that they're hammering over and over again, you know, these hundreds of thousands of Kiwis leaving.
Yeah.
There's that checklist, and I'm still trying to remember it. It's jobs, homes, something. Jobs, house, homes, jobs, something, homes. They've got this little, like, I noticed last year they had these, like, mint packets that you could buy on their merch shop to, you know, just donate to Labor or whatever, and there's jobs and homes, but I think the other one is health, but it's I'm never going to quite remember it because it's not got that catchiness, you know? It's not, let's do this, or like, I don't even remember what the next one is, but you know, a brighter future, you know? It's not those kind of things. It's not catchy, but it's very to the point. So we just, had a bit of a speech. There's a few kind of themes in it around, Labor really wanting to focus on, like, delivering the basics, not overcomplicating what they're trying to do, and make sure that the impacts can be felt by New Zealanders. And they also talked a lot about clean energy, which was quite interesting as well. Quite encouraging that a major party would really focus on that in a speech. And a little bit again about the energy security related stuff that's been in the media the last couple of weeks. So we had a pretty basic speech, and I mean, everyone is doing their sort of State of the Nation speeches, as you said. I think the Greens do the State of the Planet just to be a bit different, but this is like a development that I don't know if I love State of the Nation speeches, especially not one with a policy announcement at the end.
Yeah. It all seems a bit kind of like wolf in sheep's clothing, and then the wolf jumps out and it's like, ta-da!
yeah. Look, because what people kind of, I don't know, it's kind of hard to know what people want, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is what I do as someone who studies public opinion. It's hard to know what people actually want. Mm. I mean, we hear what the media says, we hear social media, we hear bits and pieces. But it seems to me, what people want actually is actually like a clear plan, and some so they can see the so-called green shoots that Luxon keeps promising. They can see some kind of plan or something that's going to happen materially that's going to make their lives better. And if we think back to when, you know, like I think it was 2002, I want to say, and Labor proposed, you know, interest-free student loans, that was something that people could see was really concrete. And Willis has actually challenged Hipkins on the fact that the Greens actually do have a lot of policies like that. And she said Te Pāti Māori in it because they're going to keep scaremongering about Te Pāti Māori being in government. But the Greens have those sorts of policies, like, you know, there's the taxes and then the free dental. So it's just like that's that thing that I think that is quite encouraging when people do have those policies of actually these are the changes we're going to make, whereas we don't necessarily see that from the major parties at this stage.
Yeah. It's sort of expected that we don't hear much policy announcement, you know, this early in an election year. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how much pressure gets yeah. put on words. How much pressure gets put on Labor to announce some policy as we get closer and closer, eh?
Yeah, I really enjoyed. Last night I watched Nicola Willis's response actually to Hipkins' speech, and like. She is getting very good at delivering thought-out pieces, you know. Like, I think this was something that they had decided that this would be the response, or maybe she crafted this response. But it was kind of quite good in a way. I was thinking, yeah, actually, you're hitting on some good points there. She said that she wished that she actually had some actual policy to debate because politics is a contest of ideas and policy and so on. So it was her main point. But I thought it was kind of smart, and I wonder to what extent this is tactical, that she then criticised Labor for not coming up with policies. Well. National set the election for November, and here we are in February, so you wouldn't announce policies 9 months before the election. I mean, there's still almost a third of the term to go in a way. So, you know, like, so now you've got National going, okay, where are the policies? But they were the ones who set the election for November. And I think that's kind of smart because then they can start to paint Labor as actually not having that many policies. And you see that Labor have already said, hey, we're only going to focus on a few core policies. So I think this might be a bit of a talking point that's going to come through in this election because that's that thing that's kind of hitting on that nerve in the public of who's got a plan. And so there's going to be this fight over who's got a plan in the middle. And then you're just going to see Chloe Forbrick making that face that she always makes out to the side being like, what's happening here? We've got a plan. Why is no one talking to the Greens?
She needs to like trademark that. It's pretty outstanding.
It's a good facial expression.
It's a fabulous facial.
She does make some great facial expressions. And like this is the thing is that I think we like a bit of expressiveness from our politicians. We like a bit of memeing. So
yeah, I like that. Oh, you're just full of it face from her. It's kind of like oh, it's this guy.
Yeah, because to some extent you can't interrupt when someone's talking. I mean, that's kind of disrespectful. But if you make a serious face, you know, and it's like I think it's good representation of people such as myself with expressive faces. But like I feel represented.
The facial expressions of politics. It'd be interesting to kind of compile them into. A thing. Right, let's move on to some kind of very sad news. The homelessness move on orders. It's kind of devastating to see the government make a decision like this, right?
Well, this is another issue that I'm finding quite interesting at the moment. And I know that sounds quite heartless, like I'm a dispassionate person studying it from miles away. But just the kind of way that this issue's been framed, you know, like this idea that you've got homeless people, which I think a lot of people see around Auckland. We see people who, you know, are a bit dishevelled and might be carrying, you know, gear for sleeping with them or, you know, those kind of people that you look at and you code and go, oh, that person, like, needs a bit of help, they're in a bit of trouble, you know, they need some kind of, like, housing. And I think that people can kind of see that in the CBD. And anecdotally, you know, like, I've walked downtown a few times at night and kind of seeing people and, you know, like, it's that thing that it comes back to. It's like, do you feel unsafe? I can see how people would feel unsafe. So there's that kind of broader issue, and businesses have been talking a lot about it, right? And businesses have the ear of the government. They are quite good in terms of politically organising, funding things, getting together, like, raising issues. Businesses are really good at lobbying. So the collective of businesses have been lobbying the government around these issues. The government also has this whole thing, like, remember with the gang patch ban, where they kind of have been selling that as a win. They've been selling that as, hey, we did this gang patch ban, it shows that we were hard on crime, and that equals less crime. Look at these less crime statistics, these ones that we've picked out. So that's what the government's kind of done in their gang patches. So it's almost like the government is now looking at what the businesses have said, and that, you know, different people coming into the city have felt uncomfortable, and they've gone, what can we do? Okay, these move-on orders. So this is that new kind of group of crimes or safety-type feelings, not the reality and data, because there's a lot of advocates of race. You know, it's not unhoused people that are causing this issue. It's other kind of people in the area.
Yeah, totally.
But, yeah, so they're looking at a group, and they're going, okay, what can we put in place? These move-on orders. And then putting that in place, and then later we'll turn around and say, well, we've removed, like, homeless people from the CBD or whatever it is. We've lowered crime in the CBD or whatever it is. They are, of course, putting in other measures, like, you know, having more police around Auckland Central and bits and pieces. So it's going to be one of those things that if crime in the CBD does decrease, that you're not necessarily going to be able to pinpoint one cause. But that seems to me like what's kind of going on here is that kind of business lobbying group is saying we need something urgently, and this is one of the ways the government is responding.
I just can't help. Yeah, I feel like I'm going to look back at this period and feel really sad about the lineage of policies that have led to this moment, and all of these people that will be so let down by the lack of systems in place to support them, because, you know, we had all those cuts to emergency housing. And it's been harder and harder for people to get into emergency housing. But then all of a sudden there's like, we're trying to find a short-term solution for homelessness when, you know, we haven't done anything to support people into those pathways leading up to this. Like, quite the opposite, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so something that is a long-term issue and has definitely, like, again, anecdotally seems to have gotten worse in the last couple of years, and I think there are some data to suggest that it has gotten worse.
Yeah.
So one of those kind of, and it was the same with the youth crime issues, right, and the boot camps and the gang patches, all of those issues. There's the, like, there's this bit of a thing where the government is like, okay, what is a kind of quick fix, quick win type small, like, law change that we kind of switch on and switch off that pretty much punishes a group. And might appear to have some kind of change immediately to voters or to people, not necessarily that long-term approach. And, you know, I've also been reading some kind of more critical pieces, of course, on this. Dr. Paula Moyle on LinkedIn, who's a kind of wahine Māori, does research on wahine Māori and homelessness. That's where they're workers. So was saying, you know, move on, but move on to where, which I think is kind of quite a good way of thinking of it, move on to where. Yeah. So it's like, so, you know, you move the person on, but actually where do they go? And a lot of the kind of public, the charities, the NGOs and others that are dealing in this area, working in this area, have said, you know, okay, so then what's the pathway? So the police move someone on, but where do they move them on to? And then what are the steps and support to wrap around them? And of course, when you do have these, when you put in place a law like this, you need to think about what happens in the next steps, and then do those agencies, do those NGOs, do those charities have that resourcing to be able to effectively deal with the person that is now with them? And the answer seems to be no. So, yes, it's definitely not an ideal or good policy, and does feel like one of those quick fix type band-aid ones where later we'll probably all get an ad when we're scrolling stuff or something, saying that they've put in place move-on orders, and, you know, 90% of people feel more comfortable in CBD or something like that.
I know, and it's like, do they have, just really briefly, do they have any data correlating people experiencing homelessness and increased crime rates, or is that just kind of something they've made up?
From what I've seen, just looking especially at the commentary from various experts in the area, and from what different kind of networks, NGOs and so on that support people have said, that it's actually not the homeless people causing the crime. It's again that thing where, you know, in politics where it's like there is the facts, the reality, the evidence, the data, whatever there is, and then there's the how people feel. And it's often like, you know, even with the economy, there's the economy itself, you know, there's the economists, you know, generating their cold, hard facts, with some of which I would debate, but cool. But, you know, there's those that data, that facts on the kind of one hand, and then on the other hand, there's how do people, like, effectively evaluate any given policy or any given experience or the way that they feel about politics, where they feel, whether they feel safe, do they feel there's less crime, do they feel there's green shoots in the economy, do they feel confident enough to go and buy a jet ski or whatever it is. Like, it's that kind of feeling, the kind of feelings about a certain policy issue or topic. And I think that some of these policies do more target how people feel, which is in a way actually for voting, if we're thinking of elections as a game, and this makes me very cynical about politics, but elections as a game or a sport or whatever it is where you win votes.
It's more about that, feeling.
Yeah, it's about, it's a, there's a lot of it is about the feelings about a leader, the feelings about a party, the feelings about a group of potential ministers, and the feelings about policies and whether, yeah, those parties are connecting to you on that feelings type basis.
Oh, that's all the time we have for this morning, Lara, but I could go so much deeper into that. But thank you so much for joining us on the show today, and we'll chat to you next week. Good luck with it all.
Yeah, off to organise some kind of hybrid event in Mexico anyway.
Good luck, Lara. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.